Hi, welcome to NSYNC, the podcast that explores the history and impact of some of your favorite music moments in TV and film. I'm your host, Rachel Brodsky.
And I want candy.
Sofia Coppola's famously stylized, dialogue-light interpretation of Marie Antoinette polarized critics when it originally came out in October 2006. Nearly two decades later, nearly everyone can agree that the film's post-punk and new wave soundtrack is one of the most defining ones of the 2000s.
Featuring needle drops from The Strokes, New Order, The Radio Department, Gang of Four, The Cure, Susie and the Banshees, Bow Wow Wow, Adam and the Ants, and a cameo performance by the band Phoenix, Marie Antoinette was intentionally made to look and sound modern while de-emphasizing historical accuracy.
Though there are many great needle drops from which to choose, today we're focusing on three from Bow Wow Wow, including Aphrodisiac, I Want Candy, and Fools Rush In. We also have a very special guest with us, writer and co-host of the Songs My Ex Ruined podcast, Courtney E. Smith.
How did three songs by an anti-royalist punk band end up in a movie about the last queen of France?
Let's get into it on the latest episode of NSYNC.
Let them eat cake.
I never said that.
St. Clair's Health. My community, my hospital, my commitment.
My commitment is helping my cardiac rehab patients so they can live an active and fulfilling life.
My commitment is to my patients' comfort and their confidence in me with their diagnostic scans.
My commitment is to truly care for each of our emergency patients. I see them when they are most vulnerable.
St. Clair's Health. Around the corner, ahead of the curve. St. Clair's Health. My community, my hospital, my commitment.
My commitment is to support my patients as they face their mental health challenges and help them achieve their goals.
My commitment is to give my patients the care they deserve and trust so they can get back to the life and family they love.
My commitment is to be by the sides of moms and their babies on their most memorable day.
St. Clair's Health, around the corner, ahead of the curve.
Courtney, welcome. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Thanks for letting me horn my way into the show. I've been thinking about how to get on this show for since your whole first season started, frankly. Yeah, no. Sure. Sometimes I talk back to things you say while I'm listening to the show.
Listeners, you can't see that Courtney has produced a giant list of the things that we got wrong for season.
There's just some additional context I'd like to add. Maybe we can graft me into a few episodes.
I mean, that I feel like not to like pat ourselves on any backs, but I do feel like that's a really good sign. Like when you're in the room or in the car and you just want to, you feel like you're in conversation with a person, but no, we're really happy that you're here. I'm not just saying this because you were kind enough to have me on, but we love the Songs Your Ex Ruined podcast. Will you tell us just a little bit about like you and Songs My Ex Ruined? And I think like you and your co-host, Melissa, did you launch a production company recently? Can you tell us
about that? So Melissa launched a production company called Nevermind Media. She launched it during the pandemic and asked me if I wanted to do a podcast. We started talking about Songs My Ex Ruined. It wasn't called that at the time. It was really us texting stories to each other of stupid songs men had sent us. And we ended up our first,
go on.
There are so many, but Elvis Costello's I Want You is Melissa's like number one. Many guys have put that on a mixtape for her and we both think something's wrong with them and something is. But the first podcast we did together was actually called Songs in the Key of Death and it was about murder ballads, which was a solid pandemic listen. But yeah.
I remember that
We've been working on,
yeah, that was yeah, awesome.
We've been
too.
Working on stuff
Very
together. We actually met
ballads.
In 2011 when my book Record Collecting for Girls came out. She interviewed me for the Hairpin and we've been friends ever since.
The Hairpin.
Exactly.
Oh, RIP.
Exactly.
I used to email Edith Zimmerman like I mean in my mind all the time because I felt like I always had ideas, but I think I only ever actually pitched her like twice and she was she didn't take my pitches but she was very kind about it. So yeah, I have a lot of love in my heart for the Hairpin.
It was great. R.I.P.
Yeah. RIP.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Today we're talking about Marie Antoinette and the needle drops from Bow Wow Wow, specifically I Want Candy. But I want to kind of go around the microphones and I want to know your experiences with this movie, because I think mine is significantly different based on gender and when I first saw this movie, which was, spoiler alert, 3 days ago.
You had so much more time to, like, to
be an adult.
Well, culturally, we've revisited Marie Antoinette, mm-hmm. and Marie Antoinette looks and sounds and feels and reputationally is very different 20 years after it came out. So I feel like you, Aviv, had more of, like, you went into it expecting a good experience.
I wound up, this is sort of jumping ahead, having a similar reaction to it as Courtney, you said you have to our podcast, where I was like yelling at the movie in affirmation. There are certain shots and certain compositions in this film and elements of visual storytelling where I just yelled, "Oh, come on." In sort of this disbelief of how it could be this good and how, you know, Marie holding a fan, seducing a creepy, dead-eyed Jamie Dornan is not one of the frames of the 21st century that's like
a gift.
Wait,
real quick, have you seen the Fall, I think?
Yeah, The Fall, which came out the same year, the Tarsem Singh movie.
No, the TV show, The Fall, right?
No, I haven't.
Well, it's also with Jamie Dornan, and he plays another dead-eyed character who's not meant to be sexy, but he is sexy in like an I can change him kind of way, but he will also murder you. I saw this a while back, but it was after I saw 50 Shades of Grey.
Also, another just creepy.
Yeah, and The Fall re-energized my feelings about Jamie Dornan. I was like, okay, this is appropriate dead eyes.
This is completely anachronistic to our telling of this podcast, but Tom Hardy, in his like three lines that he has in this movie, is 10 times more charming.
So much more charisma. Than, he says nothing.
Yeah, than Jamie Dornan, who's just like got bowling ball horse eyes staring at Kirsten Dunst.
So in fairness to Jamie Dornan, the character he plays is a member of the Swedish military. He's a Swede. And honestly, this is exactly what I imagine Swedish seduction is like. Full offense.
unbroken eye contact.
Really straightforward, unsubtle, but satisfying, I'm guessing.
But not blonde.
Well, I mean, at the time, the first time they meet, and this was true in real life, Marie Antoinette is like 18 and has no experience because her husband hasn't had sex with her yet. So
positively,
you know,
dickless.
Like that sort of non-subtle seduction would probably be exactly on the nose. That would be the thing that would catch her attention.
Yeah. And he doesn't treat her like a porcelain doll, which is what everyone else is doing. But back to my original question, when did you first see this movie, Courtney, and what was your reaction?
Oh, I saw it on release in theaters, and it was because of the soundtrack. Like, everyone was so obsessed with it, and because of Lost in Translation, which had come out not long before that, and everyone was so obsessed with Sofia Coppola. And it was so much bigger. Like, her other movies had been, in terms of their settings, had been more quiet and intimate, and not this. To have shot at Versailles and to be really showing this opulence was so not what we'd seen from Sofia Coppola before, that it was eye-catching. And the music, the way that she weaves it in, like, I wrote down this note where the moment whenever The Cure plays for a moment at the coronation, and then it's their birthday and the king has died and now Jason Schwartzman is the king, which is hilarious. New Order plays. And I was like, oh, I get it now. That was just like extremely on the nose. There's a New Order. Da-dum-tsh.
Hey.
Very, very mixtape forward, which is not really how we make movies anymore.
No.
But in the mid-2000s, we loved the Garden State soundtrack for everything. What about you, Rachel? Did you see it in 06 when it came out?
I don't think I saw it in the theater. I think I rented it probably on break from school because I didn't watch very much, to be honest with you. And this, in 2006, I was a sophomore in college and I didn't really watch anything at the time. I went to the movies a little bit, but it's probably night and day compared to what college kids do now is just stream everything. They're much more plugged in given the internet.
Always on their YouTubes.
And, but I remember being excited by the idea of the radio department having needle drops in any movie because I love the, I was a huge, still am a huge fan of Swedish pop music. The radio department are one of the best Swedish pop bands, I think, to come out of the 90s. And whenever they release, they're still together, they're still releasing music, and I still get excited every time. So I was going through like a huge Swedish pop phase, like at the time where I just devoured everything on their record label, Labrador Records. And that was, I think, my main connection really to the movie, because I knew about the soundtrack before I ever saw the movie. And then once I saw it, I'll be honest with you, I remember feeling a little bit underwhelmed, and I couldn't quite figure out why. And I think I felt that way too about Lost in Translation, if I'm being really, really, really honest. And I thought about that really hard upon rewatching it. Not Lost in Translation, but rewatching Marie Antoinette a few days ago. I think I just need, I'm just a wordy person. I just, not that I don't appreciate stunning visuals, and because the visuals are something to behold, with between like the cakes and the colors and the Manola Blahnik shoes and the music. It was called at the time when the movie came out, it was called like an extended music video, and I think it's better than a music video visually. But I think I just need more dialogue in my movies. I'm going to be really honest. It had nothing to do with historical accuracy or lack thereof. It was beautiful to look at, but I need people to talk to each other in order for me to really engage with moving images.
That is completely valid. I mentioned, only saw this movie for the first time this past weekend in preparation for this show, and I went into it with kind of a cultural conception of the movie that, even through its reappraisal in the last 20 years or so, I was completely different than what the movie actually was. And so for those of you listeners who are not in the know, Marie Antoinette is the classic tale of a 13-year-old Austrian princess played by Kirsten Dunst, who is engaged to Louis XVI of France, the 15-year-old Dauphin, the Prince of France, inbred within an inch of his life, and played spectacularly by one of my all-time favorite Nepo babies, Jason Schwartzman. The engagement is, of course, done not for love, but to ensure peace between Austria and France.
Right. No pressure.
Yes.
Yes. Her mother is played by Marianne Faithfull, which is like the best casting ever.
Unbelievable.
There are lots of great little casting Easter eggs in this movie.
I want to talk about Marianne Faithfull, Molly Shannon, and especially Rip Torn.
Rip Torn.
Yeah. Because Rip Torn is the key to understanding how to read this movie, I think. So Marie moves from Austria to France, where she has to strip naked at the border and is removed of her clothing, her servants, and her dog.
Mops
who won the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival in 2006.
Well, that is cute pug.
Well deserved.
Yes.
I mean, being a dog owner now, especially a small dog owner, that scene where her dog is taken from her did make me want to run over and cry for an hour.
And Mops is her first line in the movie. This all happens before she speaks a true first sentence in the movie. This is indicative of Sofia Coppola's filmmaking style. She, as Courtney mentioned, was just coming off her Oscar-nominated Lost in Translation, which is also very quiet, as well as sort of how this is also indicative of how she feels about Marie, or how other people treat Marie, which is a doll whose clothes you can strip off and redress, who you can remake to match whatever image you project onto her. And it's not just the French that do this to Marie, it's her own family. As Marie moves to Versailles and marries Schwartzman's Louis the 16th, Schwartzman, by the way, it's worth noting, is Sofia Coppola's cousin. Marie's mother, played by Marianne Faithfull, through a series of letters makes it clear to her that her only job is to get Louis to impregnate her, specifically with a male heir, in order to trap him into staying with her so she can exert influence over him in international affairs. Did I forget to mention that she's 14 years old?
Yeah, again, no pressure.
No pressure.
And no one ever explains sex to either of them, which is the best.
Which has no repercussions throughout the rest of the movie. Well, let me look at the next sentence I wrote. The main problem with this is, other than this is tantamount to slamming a Barbie and Ken doll together on your living room floor, that Louis is positively Rizless. He could not fuck his way out of a paper bag. And while
excellent analogy, excellent and timely.
Thank you. We're going to get more. While I love Kirsten Dunst's performance as Marie, the way Schwartzman holds himself as Louis, the way he cannot even look at her in the eye for the first 45 minutes of the movie shows us in no uncertain terms that this kid has no game.
He needs to view her. Well, speaking of projecting,
yeah,
he needs to project the idea of a lock onto her, because
which is ultimately how it gets done.
Yes, because so maybe you cover this later on, but I want to say that I completely forgot about this, and I was like, I know that they eventually do it,
right?
But how do they do it? Oh, that's right, by his brother-in-law, Marie's brother coming
Joseph,
to visit, yeah, and saying, hey, Louis, I hear you're obsessed with locks.
I'm going to need you to fuck my sister.
So think of her as a lock.
Yeah, which is apparently true to life. This is from biography. Louis the 16th's grandfather, Louis the 14th, played by, perplexingly in this movie, Rip Torn. We're not hosting an intergalactic kegger, Rip Torn. considered him, quote, ungainly and dim-witted. Kinder appraisers regarded him, Louis the 16th, as shy and withdrawn, living in the shadow of an attractive older brother being groomed for the crown. And when that brother died, Louis Auguste was thrust into the public role as heir apparent to the throne. And he was more interested in padlocks than he was in his young wife. Marie, who first bristles at all of the attention that the French court is paying to her, which is in contrast to her historical cultural persona, becomes a scapegoat for not producing an heir. The entire court knows that she does not fuck and blames her.
And her mother, sending her letters, asking her to please do all you can.
Please fuck.
To charm and seduce. Yeah. Hey, 15-year-old daughter.
Horrible.
Charm and seduce and get
and
pregnant.
They all blame her and her cold Austrian heart for not warming Louis's loins. And Marie eventually draws a line in the sand with Louis that they must consummate their marriage before Louis's brother, Louis the 18th, the numbering is all fucked up, is able to impregnate his wife. Of course, this time comes and goes. In reality, it took Louis and Marie 7 years of marriage to finally consummate their marriage. And as Rachel mentioned, Marie's brother, Joseph, the Emperor of Austria, played by Danny Houston in the
that
movie,
was also has to come strange and casting to me. I forgot all about that. So, when he showed up, I was just like, oh, isn't he usually the evil guy in movies?
He is. But I want to talk about the connection between Sofia Coppola, Jason Schwartzman, Asia Argento, who plays the Louis the 14th's like
mistress
consort,
yeah,
mistress, and Danny Houston a little later when we talk about like what it all means. But yes, Joseph has to convince Louis and explain to Louis exactly how to fuck his sister, comparing the act of lovemaking to what else, a lock and key. In real life, Joseph wrote letters to his and Marie's mother that, quote, the royals were two complete blunderers and didn't have any good reason to not produce an heir other than lack of inclination or perhaps lack of education. So Louis the 18th's wife, Marie Josephine of Savoy, does give birth to a baby before Schwartzman's Louis the 14th figured out what to do with his skeleton key. And Marie's... Marie's only way to react is by embracing the opulent nihilism that we know her for, partying, gambling, dressing wildly, eating chocolates, generally getting a little closer to what we, in the last 250 years, know of Marie Antoinette.
Yeah, if you think about it, if you're a teenager and a horny teenager, but you don't know where to channel that horniness and you don't perhaps understand that horniness. What would you do?
I don't think it's horniness. I think it's an existential crisis. Like, we think of her as a teenager, but the lifespan of people was much shorter than, and the marriage age and the childbearing years were much younger. That was just
and
how it worked.
She's gotten letter upon letter upon letter from her mother being if you don't do this, you're gonna
die. In fairness,
and everyone's
her mother is the reason why the current British royal family are German and not British. She married all of her children off to royal families all across Europe to solidify the position of Austria. All of her children were getting progress reports from her in terms, and she had multiple children, like I think 7 children. They were all princes or consorts or what have you somewhere in order to solidify.
Is this where we get Prince Philip then?
Before, earlier, but yes.
This is why in World War I it was a war between three cousins. Mm-hmm.
Literally.
This cultural appraisal that we all have of Marie Antoinette, by the way, is French propaganda, first made by the members of the court who didn't like an Austrian coming in and getting more favor than they did, and then by the revolutionaries who would draw pornographic pictures of the young queen and like distribute them and talk about how opulent she was. But this letting loose montage is accompanied by Bow Wow Wow's most famous song, I Want Candy. And this also features the infamous scene of modern Chuck Taylors in the background of Marie's room.
It's also perhaps the best modern take on the shopping montage that exists in film.
Modern yet
yes,
period.
Yes, exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Well, what did you guys think about that shot? I completely forgot about it, honestly. Like, I forgot about a lot else.
It was the only thing I knew about the movie.
When you first saw it, I mean, when you, Courtney, saw the modernization, I guess, and like that just the liberty is taken with the fashion in this movie, how did you feel?
I knew it was going to happen because it was in the promos that were running at the time. Like, they were very upfront about that, and everybody thought it was like this clever wink to the soundtrack and weaving in the idea that things are out of sync, that this is, you know, a modern retelling more than it's completely historically accurate.
A la A Knight's Tale.
Yes, but right. Less cheesy because it's Sofia Coppola and she had a lot more prestige than that movie.
There's got to be some deeper meaning. And to me, the most obvious one is like, this girl is a teenager. She's just like a teenager that's alive today or alive in 2006. We are putting the fate of Europe on top of her and then blaming her for not bearing a child at the age of 16.
Later, blaming her for an entire country's distress.
Exactly. And yet she's a girl in her room gossiping with her friends and eating chocolate. And eventually, like, doing drugs, right? She does drugs. She gambles. She does all this stuff that, like, she goes through the lifespan of, like, a normal human American or whatever, modern human woman. And yet is like the most famously derided woman on the planet.
Well, two things. First of all, this is post Bring It On Kirsten Dunst. So she's kind of the iconography of the modern American teenager to be cast at this time.
Great point.
And the second thing, I think there's something about just like being witty in that way that Sofia Coppola thinks she can do. I don't know that I think it's deeper than that. I don't even know that it needs to be suggested. I think it's just like Sofia Coppola has a deadpan moment of humor, but
in
her way, though, it's not a line, it's a visual.
In this moment, actually, her brother was the one, because her brother was working on the movie.
Roman Coppola?
Roman Coppola was, he was the second unit director, and apparently it was his idea to throw in a pair of blue Chucks around some period appropriate shoes made again by Manolo Blahnik. And I think you threw it in there as a joke. And then Sophia liked it, kept it in there.
But to your point, Courtney, there are these other moments of deadpan where characters like spike the camera. They like look down the camera lens being like, isn't this weird?
Yes.
And they, it's just a brief look. It happens a lot in the first half of the movie. And I think that that is a similar fourth wall break as the
chance. One of the last times it happens is at the masquerade ball when Kirsten Dunst does it. And you can be imagining she's looking at Jamie Dornan and being flirtatious, but it doesn't feel that way. It feels like she's breaking the fourth wall. And it doesn't happen after that, but it's this great moment of like, oh, I'm different now. I'm not who I was for the first half of this movie. And after this, everything will be different.
Mm-hmm. I did gain a new appreciation for Kirsten Dunst as a younger actor. I mean, she's always, I think, been like maybe one of the most appreciated, underappreciated actors. For
sure. Makes a lot of interesting choices, too.
And this, I think when I first saw Marie Antoinette, it didn't occur to me that she was playing a 13-year-old. And then over the course of the movie, she's more in her, what, late 20s? At what age did Marie Antoinette die?
So she's supposed to be 38 at the end of the movie, but it doesn't feel like she is. And
she still feels like a child.
Yeah. Well, I would say that I would give her a good 10-year span that I 100% do buy acting-wise. But I did have kind of a hard time telling, like, okay, well, how old is she now? Because, like, she does kind of plateau age-wise. But I do want to give her a hand for just the coming of age aspect, acting wise.
There's something so interesting about Coppola's camera looking at Dunst as well, because there is this motif of Marie receiving a letter from her mother, hearing it in voiceover, and then just posing against a wall or posing in a bathtub. For the camera lingers for like a minute more, and it's just this kind of beautiful Vermeer-esque tableau of her face feeling the weight of the Austrian Empire on her. And it's just so, it has all the quiet of Lost in Translation, and there are many lingering shots of Scarlett Johansson that are similar, but it feels so much bigger in scope.
Yeah.
And it's just like, Sophia Coppola knows how to shoot Kirsten Dunst better than basically anyone in the world.
So to go back to the Bow Wow Wow scene, the shopping scene.
Yes.
There's another thing happening here that we haven't really touched on. Everything in the movie up to this point, like this is a critical breaking point, and we're seeing her, in my mind, really have a crisis of who she is and that she's not doing the things that are expected of her. And will there be failure? How do I cope with it? I shut down. I turn to compulsive behaviors, multiple. Mm-hmm. It's gambling, it's drinking, it's eating, it's shopping. And all of those are displayed.
It's even going out and having this affair with Jamie Dornan's Swedish
exactly. soldier. But that's all happening. There's another breakdown of the rules that's happening. Up to this point, we've seen her chaperoned, held to the rules of the court, beholden to these schedules that are not her own, and she doesn't have any power. So with this scene, she's also getting a lot of power. And there's something about Rose Byrne's character, her friend, whose name I've forgotten now, who comes into the scene and like steps in and is like, we could do this. And Kirsten Dunst says, Marie Antoinette is like, oh no, but I can't because these rules. And she's like, but what if we do it anyway? And that just kind of keeps happening over and over. And suddenly it occurs to her, oh, I'm an adult. Oh, I'm the queen. Oh, I'm the dauphin. What is it when you're the girl? The dauphine.
Dauphine.
I'm the dauphine. Actually, I have more power than everyone else here. Why am I not doing what I want to do? And it's this breaking down of the social structure that also happens. So to me, I mean, I know it's true to Marie Antoinette, but there's something so fascinating about what that looks like for a woman and what it looks like is overconsumption.
You just made me think of something, Courtney, is like that I had not occurred to me before, but the through line thematically between this scene and the overconsumption and just the use of things, but nice things, as to sort of filling an internal void. And then Sofia Coppola's The Bling Ring a few years later, where you have people, kids, who are ransacking, of course, also a true story, but kids ransacking celebrities' homes to presumably fill an emotional void. And also probably many, many other reasons. It's a different conversation. There are obvious nuances between each situation, but the through line is stuff and lots of nice stuff.
And yeah, and absolutely. This idea that we are stripping these girls of their agency and they're going to take it back somehow. Mm-hmm.
That's where, to me, the music becomes an interesting parallel. Watching it this time, I saw that maybe I didn't the first time, but that's what punk and post-punk were. Kids stripped of their agency, stripped of really their money because they were under austerity measures, and wanting it back and finding it through creativity and self-expression and this nihilistic outlook and creating their own kind of music that would be rejected by other generations. So that's why those things are paired together to me.
I think not only is this the most crucial turning point in the movie, as you mentioned, Courtney, but it also became the emblem of what the movie was sold as. This really ornate, rich food, rich clothing, rich shoes, rich costumes, rich hair montage with this very famous song, anachronistically dropped in, became what everyone knew the movie was going to be before they even saw it. So let's talk a little bit about how Sofia Coppola came to use this Bow Wow Wow song, and even how Bow Wow Wow influenced Sofia Coppola before the movie was even made.
Okay. Well, Sofia Coppola has talked a lot in interviews, both before and since. There was a great oral history in Vogue a couple of years ago where Sofia did talk about how, like, her growing up in the 80s and, like, her exposure to that time period and coming of age, listening to Adam and the Ants. And Bow Wow Wow, of course, is like an offshoot, if you will, of Adam and the Ants. There were a few members of Adam and the Ants that went on to form Bow Wow Wow with the assistance or with the oversight of the manager of the Sex Pistols.
Oh, Malcolm McLaren.
Yeah, Malcolm McLaren.
Famously horrible dude, Malcolm McLaren.
Famously proved out to be one of the worst people in music. If there's a villain story,
basically ever.
And one of the things he did was he got a 13-year-old girl to front Bow Wow Wow by the name of Annabelle Lewin. Annabelle Lewin, she was recruited to join the band when she was 13. Coincidentally, same age as when Marie Antoinette became engaged to the French Dauphin. And Sofia Coppola conceived the style for Marie Antoinette with some inspiration from Annabelle. And Bow Wow Wow's tour manager said in 2006, according to my research, quote, they drew parallels from the fact that they were both young girls who found fame and fortune at a ridiculously early age. And we can continue to dig into Marie Antoinette and Annabelle's parallels, because they were picked up, used, abused, and, you know, one of course guillotined, and the other is still around performing. I mean, she gives interviews every now and then. She seems to have dealt with the truly awful way that the music industry treated her pretty well. She's now in her 50s, still a singer, still releases music. But wow, she, no pun intended, she was treated like trash.
Yeah.
And very it's also, formative age.
It's also worth noting, and we can't get too deep into the Malcolm McLaren thing, but Annabelle Lewin is Burmese English, of Burmese heritage. And mm-hmm. so it wasn't just this person taking like a young girl, but it was like a young girl of color, parading her up there, promising her the world, and then really
taking her clothes off.
Yeah, not great.
Painting her. There are some problematic aspects.
Oh, to, the French.
to the way that the industry presented Annabelle visually. But before we get into it, let's take a minute and listen to I Want Candy. I know a guy who's tough but sweet. He's so fine, he can be beat. He's got everything that I desire. Sets the summer sun on fire. I want candy. I want candy. I Want Candy came out in 1982. It is a cover of The Strangeloves. And got a remix by My Bloody Valentine's Kevin Shields for use in Marie Antoinette. So in this oral history that Vogue did in 2021, Brian Reitzel, who was Marie Antoinette's music supervisor, they talk about the way that the music was all put together, placed, and arranged within the film. And he says, Sophia asked me to be the music supervisor on The Virgin Suicides, because I'm a geek about music and have a huge record collection. The soundtrack for Lost in Translation came from two mix CDs that she listened to while writing the script. It was the exact same process with Marie Antoinette, and it took 3 months of me scratching my head trying to figure out what her version of a period piece would sound like.
Fans of the show, don't worry, we're going to talk about these other movies as well. Because The Virgin Suicides is one of the greatest soundtracks of the 90s, and we're not going to leave you high and dry.
Honestly, one at a time. But before before we get into some of the, as I said, problematic aspects of Bow Wow Wow and their having Annabelle front, I wanted to ask, let me turn the conversation over quickly to Courtney, and I wanted to ask about your relationship to this band, because truly, for me, like, I grew up hearing this song, and as well as Aphrodisiac, all the time, but was unfamiliar with the story behind Bow Wow Wow and really Annabelle until we got into the research for this episode. And I mean, for me, like, I'm of an age where I think the first time I heard a cover of Bow Wow Wow was like the Aaron Carter version of I Want Candy.
Whoa.
I mean, I had heard I Want Candy, of course, in tons of movies beforehand, but then Aaron Carter was famous. Then, you know, we were on the same age.
Oh, wow.
R.I.P.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, R.I.P.
So I was a child of the 80s. Hi, your elder mm-hmm. here. And I remember this song from when it came out. Actually, it was on the radio a ton. Even I grew up in Texas mm-hmm. and it was played there just a ton. I don't feel like I ever really saw it on MTV or anything, though. So I didn't know what Annabelle looked like or how old she was. Really didn't know anything about her. And I didn't know any other Bow Wow Wow songs. I think probably Fool's Rush In I would have come up against, but it didn't have quite the same, you know, everywhere-ness of I Want Candy. That was very big in my childhood, like, rotation, though. And I learned more about them when I was in my early 20s. I went into a rabbit hole of reading all the punk oral histories and books that were out there. So Simon Reynolds' Rip It Up and Start Again was the second one I read. And that's where I learned a lot about Malcolm McLaren and everything he'd been up to, and sort of the Adam and the Ant into Bow Wow Wow story. And he doesn't really get into it too much. Like, it's clear that it's not good. It's really toxic. But it's not, he doesn't evaluate the treatment of her, or even really, like, he kind of evaluates McLaren's shitty treatment of Adam Ant, but Adam Ant is also an asshole ultimately. So I don't feel too bad for him.
Let them fight.
Let them fight it out. And also, Adamant was a fully grown man at the time. So, like, honestly, he can take care of himself, probably. And I didn't fully understand Malcolm McLaren's shitty treatment of the Sex Pistols either. Like, the amount of nonsense he instigated within that band. Like, his role as just a genuinely terrible human being to everyone who worked with him.
Including, like, actively trying to keep them from getting clean.
Yes.
There's long TLDR on Malcolm McLaren. There's basically no one that he wouldn't exploit. He went to Africa, stole a bunch of music and interpolated it, and never gave the credit to the original artists. Like, he was doing this for 30, 40 years by the time he died. And
he has no morals, really, but missed. Was really great at making it sound like there was some grand reason for doing the incredibly shitty things he would constantly do.
He's the Ted Cruz of punk rock.
You mean my senator, Ted Cruz? That, cool.
That's him, but that's his thing, right? Is he'll say or do anything to just, like, aggrandize himself.
Yeah.
And he has absolutely no moral. Yeah.
It's true. Fuck.
I just bummed myself out.
Well, art and music and other areas of entertainment
and media right tend for to exploitation. Attract to,
and narcissism. Mm.
Jumpstart your career at St. Clair's Health. Discover an amazing and rewarding workplace. St. Clair's in Denville, Dover, and Booton is now hiring RNs, LPNs, CT techs, social workers, and more. Join an award-winning network of community hospitals, receive a competitive salary, and experience a great place to work with supportive coworkers in a beautiful location. Check out the bonuses. Apply today at stclairs.com/careers. That's stclairs.com/careers.
LASIK. LASIK.com.
Have a ton of questions about LASIK? You're not alone. That's why we created LASIK.com, one place where you can go to find every answer to every question on your mind. Like, how much does LASIK cost? How long does recovery take? How do I find a doctor? If you've been thinking about LASIK, go to LASIK.com now. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
So, yeah, that's sort of where I learned more. That was the first time, not until my early 20s, that I learned more about this band who I had known but hadn't delved into. And I think around this same time was when Rhino started issuing, like, the punk box and the goth box. So I got deeper into Bow Wow Wow's back catalog in the early 2000s as well.
I want to quickly go back to something you said, Aviv, about McLaren taking music from Africa and passing it off as his idea.
Basically his own, yeah.
And that is something that appears, and I want to be careful about how I word this because I don't know the backstory, but I Want Candy is an example of a use of the Bo Diddley beat, a syncopated musical rhythm that has a lot of history in rock and roll. And the Bo Diddley beat is essentially the Afro-Cuban clave rhythm. Hopefully I'm getting that pronounced right, because sometimes you read things and you don't pronounce them right.
Yeah.
So that could, I without knowing the history of the, you know, the in-studio song writing.
No, this is something that happened a ton in this kind of music. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a real problem in ska. It's a real problem in post-punk. The Clash's whole thing with this, at least Joe Strummer he didn't take credit for things that weren't his, but there was a lot of rifling through other people's cultures. And we now refer to that as colonialism, and it always was, but the way that it was looked at the time in the 70s and 80s was wildly different than how we conceptualize it now.
Yeah, I mean, to be clear, music takes inspiration globally, and I think, but the quote right thing to do is to give credit where it's due and not pass off a global idea, that wasn't yours as yours.
I have a similar ick with the term "blue-eyed soul" from like the 50s and 60s, where it's like, what you're saying is this is black music, but don't worry, the singers aren't black.
Or Northern Soul from the UK.
Oh, Jesus. So I agree, as a musician, right? You get inspired from myriad places, but I think it's your responsibility as an artist to not exploit the you yourself are trying to not get exploited. It's your job to not exploit the people that you're drawing influence from. You should punch up. These are all like kind of being a mensch 101 sort of things, but McLaren was never even a musician, right? He's listed on as a writer on hundreds if not thousands of songs, and like what was just like an archaeologist in the way that maybe Indiana Jones was, where he would take something of a different culture and be like, look what I found. Yeah.
Do I know what it is? No.
Certainly not.
So you cut in the beginning of Marie Antoinette, you kind of get the impression that like when she's woken up for the first time in her new bed in the Palace of Versailles, they
like haze her.
Yeah, they take off her nightgown and say it's a great honor for a blood family member to dress you in the morning. And then new people keep coming in and supposedly outrank the last one. And so, but they essentially keep Marie naked and holding her breasts and just waiting to be dressed. And it's like Aviv said, it's like she's being hazed. And in a similar sense, although I think they probably, the music industry would probably try to frame it as empowering, though it's, if you're under 18, this is not empowering. But to go back to the nude photography of Annabelle Lewin, the first album cover of Bow Wow Wow, their 1981 debut album, See Jungle, Go Join Your Gang, Yeah, City All Over, Go Ape Crazy, which I don't know about that, but they depict the band recreating Edouard Manet's Le Déjeuner sur l'Herbe with Lewin posing nude. So if you've never seen that painting, it is two men dressed and one naked woman sitting arranged having a picnic in a park. And Annabelle, then 14, was playing, posing as the woman in this photo, and she is fully nude, and it caused, it was scandalous at the time. It caused an outrage that actually did lead to an investigation by Scotland Yard, instigated by Lewin's own mother. Then,
cool.
The band just, instead of making any apologies or whatever, or saying, well, maybe this 14-year-old is too young to be naked on the cover of something that's going to be released, at least nationally, they dug in, and then they used the same photo on the cover of their follow-up EP, The Last of the Mohicans, and the sleeve of the Go Wild in the Country single.
But they never put her naked on an album cover again after that, right?
No, they definitely did.
Oh, good.
Yeah, they put another nude photo of Lewin on for the cover of I Want Candy, the album, less than a year later.
So hold up. You cannot like recreate that Manet painting and say you didn't know it would be scandalous, or even that you're doing something artistic, because that was a piece of cheesecake art even when it came out, to the point where Manet himself later on painted a woman looking direct, a naked woman who was a sex worker looking directly at the person on the other side of the canvas, specifically as a statement of empowerment. Like, everyone knew that was disempowering. Malcolm McLaurin, who was educated at incredible art schools, knew that was disempowering. We're talking about a man who opened a shop called Sex with Vivian Westwood, where there were body parts cut out of women's clothing. Like, the idea of provocative was more important than whatever the fuck else he was thinking of.
Malcolm, when he was a kid, faced some sexual abuse at the hands of his grandmother, and this is like absolutely not a defense of him, but it's he is a person who has a really bizarre sense, or had a really bizarre sense of propriety, whether, you know, uncharitably, just to make himself money, but like he seemed really obsessed with not people not of age and them being naked, but also,
but
like
with objectification, period, full stop.
Yeah, that's right. And the but like the record title is Sea Jungle, go join your gang, yeah, city all over, go ape crazy. Malcolm, what the fuck is wrong with you?
That doesn't make any sense, and that's the point of it. Like, for us to even have a conversation about it, it is exactly what he's going for.
Yeah.
Let's leave that right over there.
There's nothing to... There's no deeper thought there, honestly.
Rotten hell, and I hate that guy.
I've been debating whether or not to share this personal anecdote, though, about the Manet painting.
Yeah.
And my mother's gonna murder me for telling the story, but it's one of my favorite stories about my mother. So this painting is recreated as a sculpture in a nearby sculpture garden close to where I grew up in New Jersey.
Why?
I don't know if they know the hit. I've never asked, but
Hamilton Sculpture Garden.
It's in the Hamilton. You know it. It's the Hamilton Sculpture. Have you seen the sculpture within the Hamilton Sculpture Garden?
I don't know if I've seen this particular one, but I've been to grounds for sculpture before.
Okay. Well, this painting is recreated. I believe it's still there, at least as of 12 years ago when I was there last. It was. But the first time my family visited, we were having a day trip, cultural family day, and we passed by this painting. I'd never heard of it. All I saw was like a naked lady with two guys, and then, you know, move on to the next thing. But my mother looks around and she's admiring some foliage nearby and goes, "What a pretty bush."
Whoa.
Right on.
And okay. My sister, I'm like 17, my sister's like 13, my dad obviously is my dad, and the three of us just, there's like a beat, and the three of us just explode laughing. And I'm sorry, Mom, it's one of my favorite mom moments.
Friend of the show, Rachel's mom.
It's one of my favorite stories. Because she really was just admiring the surrounding It's a very beautiful atmosphere
with lots of amazing bushes. Well, sartorially, this is just so strange, though, because the one thing that painting has going for it is you only see the back of this woman and a touch of the buttocks. So it's like there is one small way in which she's not objectified. Make it 3D. Why?
Just get all up in there.
Do you remember the 3D being anatomically accurate?
Oh, no.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
Sofia Coppola claims to have based a little bit of Marie's styling, attitude, just like the idea of Marie on Annabelle, right?
I need to hear more about this because Annabelle had a mohawk and wore like ripped punker clothes. So what does that mean? I mean, Marie was put on some real tall wigs at this point in the movie. Is that
the hair pieces were high. I didn't find any other like her digging into
somebody made that shit up. Come on. Like there's
When Sophia is interviewed about like why she chooses what she does, her answers I think tend to be a little on the surface.
Yeah, I agree.
Like I just like it, so I did it.
This also smacks of she goes in to talk to Bow Wow Wow and is like, "I really want your song on the record. I based the main character on your lead singer."
That's what I'm hearing. That's the vibe I'm picking up.
Yeah. Perhaps there are some quotes out there. If there are, they didn't come up in my research of Annabelle talking about maybe this character, this visage being based on her. But she does talk about being fired from Bow Wow Wow in 1983, right after an album tour, like a really rough US tour. And she talked about reading about her being fired in NME in 83.
That's how she found out?
And yeah, she had to read about
That's the equivalent of getting a text message about it today. That's messed up.
She was told that they were having a break for a month before an Australian tour. And she thought, this is an actual quote, "Yay, I can rest my vocals. No one talked to me about it. No one explained it. It was all a shock." And she talked a little bit more about it in Classic Pop Magazine in 2020, where Annabelle said, "I definitely experienced bullying both personally and professionally in the industry. It was an undercurrent, really a lack of respect from how people treated me as a teenager and a female. Put it this way, it was obvious there was a difference between how men and women were treated in the music business. I never want to go through bullying again, and I never want anyone else to either."
That all rings true. I'm having worked in the music industry.
Yeah, nothing
still
has
happening.
Changed. Yeah, nothing has really changed. So I was also thinking to pivot just for a second. There's another song on the I Want Candy album,
Louis XIV.
Yeah, Louis XIV, referencing Louis XIV, who was Jason Schwartzman's Louis' grandfather.
Yeah, played the one that's played by Rip Torn in the movie.
That's his father. So this would be...
No, that's his grandfather.
Oh, that's his grandfather.
Hell yeah.
Okay, so also called the Sun King, because he was the longest acting king of the entire French monarchy. And so Louis XIV is, I think, probably... I was looking up some like overtly political songs that Bow Wow Wow did, and this was the most, I think, by a mile. Although maybe if I'm wrong, Courtney, feel free to jump in. But I wonder, like, how are you familiar with this song, and how do you feel like it connects to the film?
I don't know the story behind the song. Why don't you tell us about it, and then let's get into it, because I know that McLaren was anti-monarchist and his views tended to be grafted onto the bands he managed. So tell me what they said about the French monarchy.
So real quick, a dramatic reading of the lyrics of Louis XIV's from Bow Wow Wow. When he comes bursting through that door, Mama leaps and hits the floor, calling himself Louis XIV. He's so young and dangerous. Oh, I love it when he says so seriously, with his gun in my back, "Honey, close your eyes and think of England." Just one second.
Ooh.
So, you know.
Is that about rape? Is that about domestic rape?
Yes, certainly is. It like is absolutely rape? About domestic
yeah,
rape.
Wow, yeah, wow. That's something.
It's not saying we love the French monarchy or monarchy in general.
Certainly not. And it's painting a domestic rapist as the Sun King who
takes what he wants.
Rapes France, has these mistresses, like a famously, it would be like writing a song about how your abusive husband is Donald Trump.
Well, so, I mean, for that to be a song that came out in the early 80s during the austerity era of Margaret Thatcher in the UK and the anti-monarchist movement, because the royals were still getting a ton of money that could have been used for social relief programs, but was redirected many places, but certainly to support the lifestyle of the royal family. It makes sense. It's interesting that it ends up being a reference to the French monarchy, though, because it draws that connection between what would have been happening in their real contemporary time with the overthrow of, you know, the billionaire class in France in the 1770s.
I wonder if there's ever a conversation about whether or not this song should also appear on the soundtrack. It seems
I wonder, right? Because it as Courtney, as you put it, like there's new order when Louis the 16th is cracked, right? So it's not what you would call subtle, but maybe it's that's too unsubtle.
It's
a Louis XIV song.
Yeah, and also it doesn't really fit. Like, there's no violence quite like that that's ever depicted. There's the threat of it at the end, but you never really see anything violent happen, other than there's one moment where someone gets hit, right? And that's it.
Which is interesting, because in the categorizations of the movie on the internet or whatever, it's listed as a thriller, which I think is like completely...
I guess it's a thriller if you didn't take history in high school.
Well, what's going to happen to Marie?
Psychological thriller.
So, I mean, it definitely is psychological. but there are other Bow Wow songs on the soundtrack, right? There's Fools Rush In and Aphrodisiac.
Yeah, and I think it's so... I've forgotten this until I rewatched it. It's so interesting how they're clustered together.
Mm-hmm.
So we get I Want Candy in the montage we discussed. We get Aphrodisiac next, whenever she meets Count Deadeyes, Axel Ferguson.
Oh, who was... apparently they told Jamie Dornan, we want your character to appear like Adam Ant in Fergie. Oh,
that explains the styling. I was wondering, because everybody else has the white wigs, men at this point, and he's the only one who doesn't. He has the dark hair still.
Yeah, there's an interview out there where Jamie Dornan, I think it was in the Oral History, where he talks about feeling it. I think this was his first ever role. So he felt a considerable amount of pressure to capture that kind of sensual je ne sais quoi.
Well, if he was going for Adam Ant, he failed epically. Wow.
I explained some of the intensity, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. But I mean, also, they should have gone with way more flamboyance than they gave him. He just looks like not dandy at all.
Fine, but not to
Yeah. So there's a moment after the montage, they go to this ball. It's sort of the unraveling of the social fabric, the masked ball, and Hong Kong Garden plays, which is like one of my favorite scenes in this movie, where people are dancing these quadrilles, circle dances that are true to the time, but it's to Hong Kong Garden. And it's like obviously what they're listening to, because they're stopping on the notes and
all of these anachronistic things are like quasi-diegetic, which is very interesting too.
I love it. It's so silly. It's so confectionery, but it's delightful. And then she meets the Count and we hear Aphrodisiac. And immediately after, we hear Fools Rush In, which is, you know, an Elvis cover, in the carriage ride.
But in four, not three.
Yes.
Right? It's like they like retime it, which is very
interesting. It's faster, yes. And it's not a ballad. It's not like the tone is completely different. There's this thing that I heard about whenever I was watching TikToks about the Gilded Age recently that struck me while I was watching that scene where Fools Rush In play, where it's Dawn and she's coming home in her carriage. They were talking about how in the Gilded Age, there was this reenactment of the monarchies of this age having parties that started at 10 p.m. and lasted until 5 or 6 in the morning. And it was a show of old wealth, that they're so affluent that they don't have to have a day job. They don't have to go anywhere. Their schedules can be whatever they want it to be.
So they're not going to sue Madonna.
Yeah, exactly.
For showing up 3 hours late.
They have all the time in the world to hang around and wait. Yeah.
And she even says when Louis wants to go home, it's only 3:30 in the morning.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm like, as a 38-year-old, I'm like, oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
My back hurts in solidarity.
But yeah, all of those decisions were like these reflections of their wealth and their class, their station.
What is a weekend?
Yeah, exactly.
So, as you mentioned, Courtney, the soundtrack is what got a lot of people into the theater, right? So the soundtrack was like a huge part of the marketing of this movie.
Yeah. I mean, so Rachel was talking about the radio department, and in Lost in Translation, Phoenix had played sort of the role that the radio department play in this, where they're the low-key soundtrack throughout. And she does that with Air in The Virgin Suicides. So I think that actually got people, a lot of people, really excited about the radio department, because not everyone was on your like nerdy binge there at the time, Rachel.
I lived in the college radio station, so I was just, that was... That was my little bubble.
But it felt at that, because she had done these other things and Phoenix broke through after the last one, that it was like a kingmaker moment of, oh, is this going to be our new hip indie band? Let's see. Let's find out what they're about.
I don't know if it, well,
it did not quite have the same effect.
Yeah, it did not quite, but should have.
But it was beautiful.
Because the radio department rule.
Yeah, and that was a great, like, the atmospherics of their music as the orchestral soundtrack was perfect.
Yeah, it was really, really, I actually had to look it up because I didn't recognize them, Phoenix. And so it was like as they're playing in the parlor in one of the quieter moments where Marie is.
Oh, that was Phoenix.
Yeah.
That's the band Phoenix.
Yeah, I saw in the notes that they appear and I was like, where did I miss? And so they're the ones who are serenading her.
Regaling her. Yeah.
And with their acoustic guitars.
Which was, you know, a little reminiscent of the Barbie movie, having a man play acoustic guitar at you. But she seemed to.
Well, it's another a historic moment. I do not believe that there were acoustic guitars being played in the French court at that time.
Probably not. I watched it with a friend of mine who's a composer and who was very upset that they were still playing harpsichord because the piano had existed for like 200 years at that point.
Yes, that. But
and she just kept saying, this is wrong. This is anachronistic. Hi, AK, friend of the show.
Okay, now I'm actually really glad that I didn't watch it with Taylor because
he would also know.
He would know, and I feel like it might. I don't know. Like I, so after when we watched Maestro, I was actually very curious to see his response because just whenever I watch anything, having to do with the craft of music or with what needs to be like a historically appropriate placements of instruments. I want to see his response. And to Maestro, he was like, oh, that bored me to tears. He was just
interesting.
He just barely paid attention to it. And I can't say I blame him on it. I think he would need to be here too. Well, I don't want to speak for him.
I watched several of the interviews with Bradley Cooper about that movie afterwards because I was curious. Mm-hmm. And he just keeps talking about how he kind of like went to another place or, you know, experienced his full self while he was directing. And I was like, oh yeah, you don't know what you're doing. Okay. I don't even know anything about what you're doing. And now I'm quite certain you had no idea what you were doing. Cool.
I like the Maestro a lot, and I am a Bradley Cooper the apologist. The Maestro. Isn't it the Maestro? It's Maestro.
No, it's just Maestro. Yeah. I thought you were being ironic.
No, I like Maestro quite a bit. I think it should be called the Maestro. And I like Bradley Cooper. I'm a Bradley Cooper apologist. He's from close to where I grew up, Abington, Pennsylvania.
Okay, well, with I do like Silver Linings Playbook. I'll take I'll take a manic
Eagles.
Yeah, I'll take a manic Bradley Cooper.
But yeah, I don't know if you. I think that we have a bad conception of what acting is when every actor, in order to win an Oscar, has to be like, I lived like Leonard Bernstein. I fucked a bunch of dudes to be in this to do this movie. I was Leonard Bernstein,
sir. Yeah, well,
no one sit down. Everyone has to stand in order to see Maestro. Yeah,
I am the Maestro.
So, but I think it was, to go back to your question of you, I think it was really the Strokes that kind of were the driver of interest, because everyone is like, how the hell are you dropping a song from the Strokes into Marie Antoinette? What is that going to be? And there was also at the time a very big revival around New Order and a lot of post-punk, although some of this feels like deep cuts. Like Hong Kong Garden got a renewed life in hipster circles because of this movie. If you were putting Susie on, it was not that song. So this became, I mean, a lot of these were deeper cuts.
And anachronistic to 2006 when the movie comes out, right? It's like songs from the 70s and 80s and 90s. Right. Like Gang of Four doesn't belong in a
Gang of Four
teen
was a
rom-com.
Totally forgotten band to assert for the masses, and it wasn't super popular at hipster dance night in New York City even at the time. And after this, it sure as fuck was.
Post-punk, I think, was, of course, there are no Interpol needle drops in this movie, but the reemergence, I think, of post-punk was helped along in a popular sense by Interpol and
oh, for sure, and the Strokes
to a higher brow extent, the radio department, because I think the radio department we're doing some things that atmospherically, like I do remember there being a lot of in indie rock, but Interpol were probably the most recognizable mainstream version
I
of that.
I cannot stand Interpol. I'm so sorry.
Really? Oh.
Yeah.
They only say nice things about you.
Speak and spell. I know.
Wow.
Seven things on the list.
My boss at MTV was managing Interpol in 2001 and 2002, 2003, and left
peak Interpol.
Oh, yeah. Left his job to manage them full time. But I went to see them so many times in those, like, the EP days and the first album days. I remember one night he begged us to come out to a Bowery Ballroom show with the Walkmen headlining and Interpol opening for them. And
ooh, that's a good show.
It was raining, yeah, and there was nobody there. There were literally like a half dozen people there. It was awesome.
Ooh. The Walkmen are like the missing link in this movie soundtrack.
I agree.
That's for real. I have a similar story with MGMT. I saw them open for the Fiery Furnaces.
Whoa.
The Fiery Furnaces, one of my all-time faves.
And MGMT, this was in Boston as they were just like right before they just started to get big. They're kind of from Boston. And they were so boring that I forgot that I saw them.
MGMT so were?
Yeah. So when they hit big with Kids, I was like, I don't care for this band. And my girlfriend at the time was like, we saw them.
And you're like, oh.
Not a single, nothing sure. Got in. But if I wasn't clear enough in my recap of this movie, I positively loved this movie. And I think that there are so many really interesting moments. I mentioned Marie and the Fan, which I like audibly yelled because it was just such a beautiful frame. But it has a lot of this Sofia Coppola quietness, which doesn't always do it for you, Rachel.
No.
But there's this incredible visual storytelling moment. So there's no,
I respect it more than I like it.
Sure. Which is, I mean, I'm not upset at you for not liking the things that I like, but there's
that would make you one of very few men in my life who would say that. I wish
you
more.
Have to like the things that I also
or
like.
Else let me explain them to you until you like them.
This is why you're wrong.
Which brings us full circle back to the songs my ex ruined podcast.
Yes, that's very true. But there's, I want to talk about like a almost music-less moment. I think that there's a little bit of soundtrack to this, but it's one of my absolute favorite moments of the movie, which contains a lot of amazing moments, which is kind of the answer to the Bow Wow Wow montage, where the servants hang a portrait of Marie and her three children, and then, with the subtle application of a cut, they take that portrait down and rehang a portrait with her and two children. And I nearly started crying. I think that that was one of the greatest ways to show this tragedy of this family and how it is so public for everyone to see. And like the fact that they are or are not having kids is like a matter of international renown. And yet, you know, this mother loses a baby. This movie was produced on a $40 million budget, which would be about $65 or $70 million today.
Gorgeous for that amount of money.
So this is, I have a new rule in my life, which is if you can do this for $40 million, no movie needs to cost more than that.
I agree.
They shot at actual Versailles.
Although, how tricky do you think it would be for someone without a Coppola last name or the equivalent to get that kind of clearance?
And also, there are moments where she's just shooting Kirsten Dunst standing around beautiful things, and I was very cognizant of how she's not touching the things around her, and I'm like, actual Versailles.
Oh, you can't touch that curtain. But yeah, I think this movie has Nepo baby all-stars, right? Sofia Coppola, Jason Schwartzman, Danny Huston, Asia Argento, who's the daughter of Dario Argento. And so what does it mean? Uncharitably, it could be that Sofia Coppola is just like casting the people she knows, and she knows a bunch of Nepo babies. But
how does that make her different from pretty much any other filmmaker?
Anybody.
Everyone casts their friends. Everyone hires their friends.
I agree. But if I hopefully can do a galaxy brain reading of it, that we are dealing with these trapped, kept rich kids whose previous generation is in control. Danny Huston, by the way, is the son of famous Western director John Huston.
Okay.
Kept trapped, golden handcuffs generation of kids who are playing with their parents' toys and parents' money and eventually are going to be crucified and have their heads cut off for it. So I think maybe, if I'm reaching a little bit, she is making a commentary about like her own
golden life, handcuffs.
her own golden handcuffs. But she also is a Coppola and gets to shoot in Versailles for real. So like, how bad?
I mean, Francis Ford was an executive producer on the movie, so it couldn't have been too bad.
Yeah, it was an American Zoetrope movie, which also kept her from having to ever deal with Harvey Weinstein,
which is heavenly.
Do what you can. My whole thing with Nepo baby culture, which I've probably ranted about on this podcast before, because it's such a germane conversation
for sure
in the 2020s. It's just that there are many truths at once. Yes, there have always been Nepo babies, particularly in Hollywood and entertainment and music. But we talk about them more today because we live in a time of increased income inequality. And it's just more in the conversation than ever, than probably the most in my lifetime anyway, just talking about like there was an article in the Times a few weeks ago, like, as of this recording date, where the Times writer is trying to figure out what Kevin McAllister in Home Alone's father must do living,
right?
Based on the enormity of their house. And I thought a lot about that article and why
he's running a Ponzi scheme or something.
But
a cult. It's a
people
cult.
Our age and younger want to know because what Kevin McAllister's father is like, he's the adult and now we're the adults and our lives don't look anything remotely like that. So income is such a part of the conversation now and generational wealth, who has it and who doesn't, the lie of the American dream and so on and so forth.
Generational access
for sure. So when Nepo babies are asked about their status and say, well, I had to work really, really hard, no one is saying that you didn't work really, really. Clearly, Sofia Coppola worked inordinately hard on labor. This movie. This movie is just a labor of love in its decadence and its detail, its attention to detail. If not historical detail, then visual detail.
I think it's more historically accurate than I was expecting, for sure.
Mm-hmm. It's more historically accurate than every Catherine the Great thing I've seen in the last 5 years.
Fact.
Sure.
Utter fact.
And I also don't think it would be as held to that standard today.
Agree.
Yeah.
I think we're holding this movie to a lot of standards that we don't hold other movies to, but
I want to address the Nepo baby question. I find it really fascinating that this is a conversation we've become so fixated on in entertainment and entertainment coverage. And I don't know if it's the proliferation or like a trend that is eating its own tail in terms of reportage, but this exists in every aspect of the world. Rich people, yes.
Yes.
Literally before this today, I interviewed a Coors heiress on the salad company that she's trying to franchise within the realm of restaurants that Coors owns. But younger people, too, you tend to believe what's available to you is what you can see. If you can't see it, you can't be it, which is literally why we talk about the Go-Go's being important to be in the Rock Hall of Fame.
Right, you know? Yes.
So a lot of people become what their parents were because they have family history within that industry. They have connections, whatever that industry and might access. Be. Exactly. It could be life insurance, but here it's movies.
I have kind of like a wild theory about the backlash against nepotism babies in Hollywood too, which is like part of Hollywood, especially acting and directing and kind of these like craft person like jobs, there the myth of how you got there is as important as the work that you do. Mm-hmm. And so everyone has to pretend, like music too, that they're like an overnight sensation, they slept in their van, yeah. whatever. Everyone's trying to be Jewel, right? And
I think Jewel would like to hear that because Jewel was treated horribly.
And yet, like you said, it doesn't mean that these people didn't work hard. They just like are in the family business. I think the person that has put the nepotism conversation the best is Jamie Lee Curtis when mm-hmm. she said, okay, they were down to me and another actress when they were casting Halloween and they cast the girl that was the daughter of the woman from Psycho. Like, it makes sense.
It's a good
it was better
story.
For them. It was mm-hmm. better for me. Mm-hmm. It's a good story. And we all worked hard, but like I would be lying if I didn't say that I got cast because I was that pushed me over the edge,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. Yeah. All she did was acknowledge that yes, this exists.
And I think that's all crucifying her for it.
Yeah, I think that's all anybody is asking for when they use the word Nepo baby as a stigma is that the Nepo babies not take on a defensive
just
narrative.
Admit that you had help.
Just to admit that this is a thing that exists and yes, I benefit from it in addition to doing hard work.
Ultimately, the movie Marie Antoinette ends with a Sofia Coppola trademark whimper instead of a bang. After subverting the famously apocryphal Marie Antoinette quote where she was told her people are starving and they have no bread, she supposedly responded, "Let them eat brioche," which is has since been anglicized to "let them eat cake," but that actually never happened. The revolutionaries storm the Bastille. Marie and Louis, along with their two children, are forced to flee Versailles. And instead of a more traditional director, think of like a Ridley Scott flourish of having
Marie. Are we talking about the opening of Napoleon? Not the Napoleon?
I'm always talking about the opening of the Napoleon.
I liked the Napoleon, and I was kind of thinking maybe it was picking up where this movie left off.
I don't think you're wrong, but like think of how Ridley Scott would end this movie with Marie and Louis dragged from Versailles and marched to the guillotine yeah. where she's relieved of her head, which is literally how Napoleon starts.
The Napoleon, sorry. It is Napoleon.
Instead, in Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette, we get this quiet goodbye. The movie ends as it began, with a girl being forced from her home and going on a long carriage ride. And the final shot of the movie is a chandelier laying broken in Versailles, the door ripped from its hinges. Because the chandelier you see is Marie. Something ornate and opulent and obsolete and kept tethered to this palace high above everyone else with no real purpose other than to be admired by the people who bought her, now dashed to pieces by an angry mob. It's as peaceful a beheading as has ever been put on film. And yet, people rejected this movie.
Well, let's think about the place and time. 2006, women...
everything was great.
...were objectified roundly in culture. Thinness was priority. You see it on display in this movie in Kirsten Dunst's body.
You can see her spine. Mm. She looks like a dinosaur.
Yeah.
Mm. And I don't want to objectify her body, but I was just shocked to see how thin she is.
Well, there are also multiple outfits where I'm like, this woman's body looks like a column. And she has breasts that there's no way this body
would
have. Lots
of corsets.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, things were not great for women. And so the idea that we would respect the ending of a significant woman in history, that we would not completely denigrate her or show the most vile thing that happens in her life, is like the payoff's not there because the viewer still wants to look through the lens of objectification, because sure. of the times when the it's mob. Made.
We're the pitchfork mob that's chanting, "We want the queen" at the end of the movie, and she just bows before us.
We feel cheated if we don't get her head.
For sure. And I think that this is also a problem with the movie's marketing, because it wasn't marketed as a quiet meditation on what it means to be a woman shackled in golden handcuffs, but rather this kind of light, fun comedy romance.
Well,
I watched the trailer.
Can we talk about the opening scene? I mean, I've always wondered, and I don't know if that was tacked on after the fact or what, or if it's like a nod to the marketing of the movie, or if it's something else, like if it's on purpose. But this Kirsten Dunst as Marie Antoinette reclining in a tub with the full wig, the full makeup, the French court makeup, the beauty mark, everything, eating little, you know, bonbons and looking directly at the camera while Gang of Four's Naturals Not In It plays is just like the cheekiest everything you think is real is not real moment. Or is it like, is that we had to have this because the marketing was what it was?
I am kind of more charitable to the filmmaker, because this mirrors the only other time you see her in the bath with the full court makeup and hair eating the bonbons is where she says, looks directly at the camera and says, "Let them eat cake." And then it cuts to the real Marie saying, "I never said that."
Yeah.
So I think that what we're seeing is a macrocosm of that scene where she's in the bathtub. She's appearing the way that we expect her to appear. And then the rest of the movie is her saying, "That's not what happened."
Yeah.
That's to me what my reading is. But
she's also generally sad in the bath.
Yes.
In most of her bathtub scenes.
A lot of great sad bathtub moments in this.
Yeah. She's definitely Britney Spears / Rihanna sad in the bath.
I was going to say it's a preview of Melancholia.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my
it's
God.
A preview of Melancholia. Absolutely. And so, I mean, if I had to really like read into it, that if she's like, from the neck up, dressed up, I feel like that's what everyone like that. That's the projection, Marie Antoinette, and then everything below the neck.
So then is the marketing team for the movie just watched the first few seconds and was like, "We know what to do. We've got it."
Or, I mean, that's very charitable that you think that they wouldn't straight up lie to you. The movie studio was doing whatever they could. They were selling the Bow Wow Wow, I Want Candy montage, because they didn't care once they had your money. Movie theaters famously do not give refunds. And that led to really mixed reviews. The film holds a 58% on Rotten Tomatoes, which isn't like a super good aggregate of, you know, whatever. Rotten Tomatoes is very flawed.
Yeah.
It made $61 million off of a $40 million budget, which if you've listened to the show before, you know, is considered a commercial failure. The People Magazine's movie critic Leah Rosen wrote in her wrap up from Cannes that, quote, "The absence of political context upset most critics of Marie Antoinette." And she called this director Sofia Coppola's featherweight follow-up to Lost in Translation. Her historical biopic plays like a pop video with Kirsten Dunst as the doomed 18th century French queen acting like a teenage Flibberty Gibbet intent on being the leader of the cool kids club.
Okay.
I have no fucking idea what movie she saw.
Two problems here. The first problem is not with that review, but look, premiering at Cannes is a huge honor, but maybe it's not the right fit for this movie. Like, perhaps
people in France really they liked it more than the US.
Yeah, the two countries had a very divergent
opinion of this movie, for sure. Yeah.
And second, that is just the continued, like, this was very bad in the 2000s, the continued erasure of the taste of teenage girls or the lives of teenage girls. Like, this is, you know, the tail end of Backstreet and NSYNC and Britney Spears, and all that was very much derided by serious criticism. So,
as well as serious music, ironically, given the soundtrack, the intentionality of the soundtrack here, and considering how highbrow it is in terms of like music listenership and what critics wanted to listen to, as opposed to the pop mainstream, it is kind of funny just to have it be like the movie itself, like be written off like that as
a movie for girls. A lot of those things were reclaimed songs that had been pop music in the time that they were released, you know, and it's been repackaged for hipsters of the 2000s, but that doesn't mean that's what it was.
Along with the wood in their coffee shop.
but this becomes my final question, right? Did this anachronistic music throw people off? Did it give the sense that the movie was not as heavyweight as it actually is?
Yes.
And is that Sofia Coppola's fault? I don't think so. Or was it the literati, the serious cinema appreciators in scare quotes, just looking for an excuse to write off this young woman filmmaker?
To me, it's a disconnection in what constitutes seriousness at the time. So if you're talking serious historians, serious filmmakers, they would not appreciate the levity of that soundtrack, whereas serious music critics were interested in this film because of the seriousness of the soundtrack
and the juxtaposition of the soundtrack and the visuals.
Yes.
I have a question for your question, Aviv.
Oh, please.
Do you think...
Reject my premise, why don't you?
Well, it's more just my brain bouncing to something else, currently trying to like mirror the moment. Do you think that that the award show, the decision makers, and to an extent critics, might be doing the same thing with Barbie right now?
I think so, but for a different reason. I think that I kind of led you to my answer, which was I think the critics will take any excuse to write off a thing as being unserious, especially one that bucks any kind of norm.
Made by women.
Yeah, but by people of color, for people of color, it's like anything that disrupts the jello will be rejected. We see this a lot with women. We see this a lot with people of color. There is this unspoken rule in Hollywood that, quote, black doesn't travel, that, oh, well, we're not racist. We'll make movies starring black people, but it won't do well overseas. Meanwhile, The Fast and the Furious, which is the most diverse movie franchise basically ever, is like incredibly popular all over the world, but that doesn't count, right? Anything that breaks the preconceived notion in any way is seen as an anomaly, and anything that upholds it, like this being a commercial failure, is seen as, well, this is why you shouldn't give a woman $40 million, no matter what her last name is. And this put Sofia Coppola in director jail for 4 years. She didn't make another movie for 4 years, which is a little long in the lifespan of a director. But Roger Ebert, the great Roger Ebert, gave the film 4 stars out of 4. He seemed to get it. And he stated that, quote, every criticism I have read of this film would alter its fragile magic and reduce its romantic and tragic poignancy to the level of an instructional film. This is Sofia Coppola's third film centering on the loneliness of being female and surrounded by a world that knows how to use you, but not how to value you and understand you.
Wow, he could have written that about Priscilla.
I think so. I think after spending 4 years in director's jail, Sofia Coppola has made 4 additional films that could fit the same brief.
Mm, mm-hmm.
7 out of her 9 films could be said about this, including last year's Priscilla, which is about the life of Priscilla Presley, though I don't think she wears chucks in the film.
We never know. There were some long pants.
That's true. Rachel, any last thoughts?
Only that I have yet to see Priscilla.
Me too.
But as soon as it's on some streaming service and doesn't like cost me $20 to watch it, it's on my list.
It will be part of my awards season catch up.
I was going to say,
sure.
Do you need me to send you a screener? Because
I'll take a screener. I collect Blu-rays. If anyone wants to send us Blu-rays, if American Zoetrope wants to send me a Blu-ray of Marie Antoinette, I hope you know that the transfer on Amazon is in the wrong aspect ratio.
If anyone wants to send me a Blu-ray player, because I was telling Aviv before we started that I don't have a way to watch or listen to physical media in my house, except for records. I have a record player.
Hell yeah.
And that would be awesome. Also, if you haven't listened to the radio department, highly recommend that you listen to the radio department and every other band on the Labrador Records. Well, they're not on there anymore, I don't think, but
that has ever been on.
Go down the Labrador Records rabbit hole. You won't regret it. That's my final thought. That is it for this week. Courtney E. Smith, where can we find you?
In
hell. Tell us about where.
No.
We're all in hell.
Where can we find you on lay internet?
I really recommend that you go search me on Instagram, because it's where I post a lot of food photos from my job as editor of Eater Dallas, and you can be very jealous of the things that I consume.
Follow. Thank you so much for joining us. It has been a real pleasure, and we're so excited that we got to have you on the show.
Thank you. It was awesome.
And thank you, listeners, for listening. We're edited by Katie Yonner, production coordinator Kyle Bosch, associate producer Lou Barron, social media producer Dale Stamfleet, executive producer Tommy West, original music by Taylor Barefoot. We are a pro Taylor podcast. InSync is a production of Gotham West Studios. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter. Your mama named you Twitter. I'm going to call you Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at the InSync podcast. And until next time, I'm Aviv Rubinstein.
I'm Rachel Brodsky. Thank you for listening.
We'll see you next time. Don't do nothing, just let's
win. LASIK, LASIK.com.
Have a ton of questions about LASIK? You're not alone. That's why we created LASIK.com. One place where you can go to find every answer to every question on your mind. Like, how much does LASIK cost? How long does recovery take? How do I find a doctor? If you've been thinking about LASIK, go to LASIK.com now. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com. LASIK, LASIK.com.
Have a ton of questions about LASIK? You're not alone. That's why we created LASIK.com, one place where you can go to find every answer to every question on your mind. Like, how much does LASIK cost? How long does recovery take? How do I find a doctor? If you've been thinking about LASIK, go to LASIK.com now. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.